We're up to Perek Hey, to chapter 5. We have begun the 3 weeks, and what we're going to learn tonight is going to reflect the 3 weeks. You're not going to walk out of here feeling really good about your Chesco, about the faith. This is a pretty downer, this Perek. Before we do that, though, I'll share with you that I came across something which I had not seen before, and I thought it was interesting, and it relates to something we learned back in the first chapter, the first parak. I saw today that, the halacha is, this I didn't see today, but I'll tell you what I saw today. The halacha is, as you know, that you have to give tzedakah. There's a mitzvah to give tzedakah, to give money to the poor. We know that there's a notion of meiser, giving 10% of your income to tzedakah. So there's a discussion in halacha how much to give and who's an appropriate recipient and from what's considered income, what can you deduct from your income, etc., etc. There's all kinds of details about it. But there, even someone who is very poor is not obligated to give meiser, to give 10%. They're very poor and they themselves are tzedakah recipients, then they don't give 10% of their assets. Of their income to meiser, to tzedakah, because they are recipients. However, there still is a mitzvah, even on the poorest person, to give some tzedakah, but not meiser. So how much is even the poorest person obligated to give? So even the poorest person, if they can, they should try to give a third of a shekel. That's the halacha. That's what it says in the Gemara, a third of a shekel. So what I saw today is, what is this third of a shekel? Why? What number is that? Where does that come from? So you mathematicians will follow closely. That I saw an explanation in the Aruch HaShulchan today. There are 768 prutos in a shekel. A pruta is generally considered the smallest amount, smallest value that is still considered worth anything. We know that in halacha, if you want something to be worth anything, it has to be at least a shava pruta. It has to be at least a pruta. When a man gives a woman money to marry her, that's what the ring is. It's money to marry her. It has to be valued at least a shava pruta, at least the value of a pruta. That's the lowest amount of money. It's still considered money. It's very small. So in today's terms, I think they used to say a pruta would be a penny. Although I think today it may be a little bit more than that, 2, 3, 4 pennies. It's certainly not more than a nickel. So we're talking about a very small amount of money. So there are 768 prutos in a shekel. So a third of 768. I was going to say it was kind of a figure out before. It's 256. So a third of a shekel, which is the minimum amount of money that even the poorest person should give towards tzedakah, is 256 prutos. So the question is, why 256 prutos? So it relates to something that we learned in the first parak of Yechezkel. Anybody remember? This is the test. You're all on the spot. You know, we just have to redo the whole thing. Start from the beginning off. 256 is the number of wings that each of the chayos have. If you recall, the chayos each have four faces. The face of a person, an adam, a nesher, an eagle, an ari, a lion, and it started as a shor, as an ox, and then turned into a kruv, to a cherub. But there are four faces. Each one of those four faces appears on all four sides of the chaya. Each chaya has each of these four faces on all four sides, and each chaya has each face four times on all four sides. So in other words, there's 16 faces on each of the four sides of the chaya. The chaya looks the same from every direction. There's 16 faces on every side. Each one of those four faces times four. There's 16 faces on each side, front, back, right, and left of the chaya. And each face has four wings. So there's 16 faces on all four sides, which is 64 faces total. and each one of those has four wings, which comes out to 256. So the 256 prutas that a person should give is equivalent to the amount of wings that a chaya has, each of the chayas has. And so I saw the Aruch HaShulchan wanted to say that, although I must admit, I think I am making an error, because I think it's 256 total of all four chayos. Okay, I'll have to look it up in a moment. It may be a total of 256 all around. Each one has 64. Let me double check that before you commit it. I mean, it's in your notes already. Now you have to scratch it out.
It's on tape.
It's on tape too. Oh no. Forever. So what the Aruch HaShulchan says is that those chayos are the ones that kiviyachol, as if it were possible, hold up the Merkava. Those wings hold up the chariot that Hashem kiviyachol rides, and of course he doesn't need a chariot to ride, and of course the chariot doesn't need to be held up, etc. But the way Hashem set it up is that these wings are the things that elevate the Merkava. And so the Aruch HaShulchan writes that tzedakah is Meromeim Goy. It lifts up the nation. The fact that we, Jews, are Baalei Tzedakah, that we give tzedakah to each other, and that we watch out for each other, and that every single person participates in tzedakah, even the poorest person still tries to do something, that is Meromeim Goy, the Pasuk says. It uplifts the nation, just as the wings of the Chayos uplift the Merkava of Hashem. That's what he says. Let me double check that real quick about the faces, because now that we've said the whole thing again. It was 256. I just remember it was 256 cumulative of all four, or if it was 256 per chaya. Yeah. So okay, I was wrong the way I said it to you. Yeah, it's 64 per chaya. There are four chayas, which is 256. So let me go through that again. I'm sorry. They each have four faces. Now, like I said, it's not all four faces in every direction. It's one direction in the front. Which one was it? The front was the Adam. The back was the Nesher, was the eagle. To the right was the Aryeh, was the lion. And to the left started as a shar, as an ox, and reverted to a cherub, to a crow. And but each face appeared four times on the side. So there were four Adam faces in front, four Nesher faces in back, four Aryeh faces on the right, and four Shar faces on the left. And each face had four wings. So there were 16 faces per Chaya, 64 wings per Chaya. There are four Chayos, and you end up with 256 wings total. So there are 256 wings elevating this Merkava of Hashem, and that's what the Tzedakah is reminiscent of. So that was a nice thing, and I saw it today, and it was nice to have an opportunity to share it with you, since we did learn it together back in the first parak. As I said, though, now that in the fifth parak, this is not going to be a pleasant discussion. Let's just recap where we're holding here. Remember that Yechezkel has built this model of Yerushalayim, and this he has built a siege around Yerushalayim, and his actions are foreshadowing and also atoning for the Jewish people, and also foreshadowing all of the calamity that is going to come in the future with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And here we follow with a little more of the story and what happens, and then Hashem is going to he's going to sum it up with some pretty negative premonitions of the future. Ve'atoven Adam kachlocha cherev chada, you son of man, take for yourself a sharp sword. Tar Hagalavim, the razor of the Galavim. Galavim literally means the razor of the those that tan hides, that process hides. When they process hides, so you need to take a razor in order to scrape off the hair that's on the hide and to make it smooth. And that's what the tar is for, the razor. Tar Hagalavim Kikachel Alach, the razor of the tanners you should take for yourself. And you should put it on your head, and you should pass it on your head and on your beard. And you should take for yourself a scale. And you should divide them up. Using a scale, you should divide them up into even piles. So he was supposed to take a razor, shave off the hair of his head and his beard, and then use that, and then weigh the hair. Now, you can ask that what about the iser, the prohibition against a man shaving with a razor, which is a good question. It seems that Hashem tells him here to do something which is normally not permitted. Just to recap, so everybody's on the same page, the mitzvah does not apply to women, but men have two different mitzvahs that apply to hair cutting or hair shaving, and that is that a man is not allowed to shave his beard with a razor. There are five places on the beard where a man is not allowed to apply a razor to. We are not exactly sure where the five places are, and therefore the accepted practice is that men do not use a razor at all on their beard. A man is allowed to cut the hair even very short with scissors, and that's why the electric razors that use a scissor-like action instead of a razor, not a single blade shaving off the hair, but rather it's a scissors action, as long as one blade isn't just cutting hair, but the two together are cutting hair, that is permitted, even if it's very, very short. And there's a whole discussion about which shavers are okay, which aren't okay, which of them act as a scissors action, and which of them act as a razor. But at any rate, a razor is prohibited, and a scissors is permitted. That's on the beard. That's one iser, that's one prohibition. There's a second prohibition against rounding the head for a man. And that's where peos come from, the peos harosh, where a man has to keep his sideburns. He can't even cut them with scissors. He has to make sure to keep the hair from the head from being rounded, that the hair on the head be a complete circle, and that there are sideburns that jut down, in order to keep that from happening. And that's a separate prohibition. And that's usur, that's prohibited even with scissors. A man can't cut that part of the head of the hair. Again, it seems that Yechezkel was told to do everything, and if that is so, we would have to say that here Hashem is telling him a directive to do differently than what is normally the case. Obviously, nobody on their own can go against the Torah, but if Hashem himself tells you to do something differently, for example, we know that Abraham Avinu was given a mitzvah of Akedas Yitzchak, of slaughtering his own son. Now, murder is prohibited in the Torah. This is also the discussion we're about to have this coming Sunday. That's what we're up to in our in-depth Chumash class. We're up to Akedas Yitzchak. So we know that it is prohibited to murder. So how could Abraham murder his own son? Now, we know he ended up not doing it, but at first he was going to do it. So how could he do that? Because Hashem told him to do it. But the Gemara itself asks, how could Yitzchak listen to Avraham to be slaughtered? Yitzchak also has to keep the Torah. So if it's prohibited to commit murder, he shouldn't be allowed to allow his father to commit murder. If his father tells him, God appeared to me and told me to murder you, Yitzchak can't listen to that. You're not allowed to listen to your parents if they tell you to go against the Torah. And even though the Torah wasn't given yet, but murder is one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, it's one of the seven Noahide laws, and Yitzchak couldn't go along with it. And so the Gemara says that Yitzchak had to have known that his father was a Navi, was a prophet, and that his father was telling the truth when he said that Hashem told me to murder you, to kill you, to slaughter you. And that's the only reason why Yitzchak was allowed to listen. But if Hashem gives a person a directive to do against the Torah, then the person can't listen to that. It's just that none of us can ever believe that Hashem told anybody to go against the Torah, because how do we know that? And so, let me just digress just to make this a little bit more clear. We know that one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, one of the 13, we're sitting in this room, we have to talk about the Yud Gimel Ikrim, the 13, what is it, the principles of faith. Right. So one of them is that Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest Navi, is the greatest prophet. And no prophet could ever, never was and never will be a prophet greater than Moshe. Even Mashiach, may he come speedily and in our days, who will be an unbelievable prophet, he will be second to Moshe. He will be greater than Shlomo HaMelech in Chachmah. He'll be wiser than Solomon, even though Shlomo HaMelech is the wisest of all men to date, but Mashiach will exceed him. But he will be second to Moshe in nevuah, in prophecy. He can't be greater than Moshe. Why is that? Why do we have to believe? Why is that an ikkar? Why is that a necessary component of our faith? Why do we have to believe that Moshe is the greatest prophet ever? Because what? It's true, but why do we have to believe that nobody can ever be bigger?
No one can deny what Moshe said.
Okay, because if I could be, if it's theoretically possible for me to be a greater prophet than Moshe, then I could come along and say to you that yes, Hashem told Moshe that you have to keep Shabbos, but Hashem told me that in 2007 that's no longer applicable. We don't have to keep the, we don't have to keep Shabbos anymore because I'm a greater prophet than Moshe. But you'll know that that's not true because nobody can ever be a greater prophet than Moshe. So whatever Moshe said is immutable. So that is a basic component of our emunah. So that is normally the case, and therefore, unless Hashem actually speaks to you directly and tells you to go against the Torah, you can't. But if Hashem does tell you to go against it, you can, because He told you to do it. So here, if Hashem is telling him, and I'm not sure if he is or isn't, if Hashem is telling him to actually shave with a razor those parts which you're normally not allowed to, we would have to say that's because he's allowed to do it in this case because Hashem told him directly to do it. At any rate, he's supposed to shave the hair on his head and on his beard, and he is to weigh them. Then he's supposed to divide them up equally. Pasuk Beis, verse 2, Shlishis ba'ur tav'ir b'socha'ir, a third of the hair, you should burn it in fire in the middle of the city. Kimlos yemei ha'matzor, when the days of the siege are over, after he's waited all of those days, the 390 days and then the additional 40 days, then, which we learned in the last parak, then you should burn a third of it in fire in the middle of that city that he built. And you should take a third. You should hit it with a sword, which means chop it up with a sword. Around that city. And the third, you should scatter to the wind. And I will send a sword after them, after that hair. You should take from there a little, a tiny little amount, a little bit. And you should wrap them in your cloak. And from them, from that little bit which you wrapped in your cloak, you should take a little, again, you should take some, and throw them into the fire. Burn them in the fire. From here will come out fire to all of the house of Yisrael. From all these ramazim, all these secrets that I'm telling you to do, all these things I'm telling you to do, this will come out fire to all the base Israel. Kamar Hashem Elokim, so said Hashem God, Zos Yerushalayim, this Yerushalayim, B'soch HaGoyim Samti, I place it in the middle of the nations. Usvivosel Aratzos, and around it are lands. And this is one of the psukim from where we learn that Yerushalayim is in the middle of the earth. So although, if you look at the earth based on the equator, Yerushalayim does not come out right in the middle, but we know that that is where Hashem created the world from. You can picture it as a funnel. Hashem sent down the force of creation down to where Yerushalayim is, and then from there it spread around the globe. But that is the point where creation started, the Eben HaShisiyah. So the Yerushalayim is in the middle of the globe. That's where I put it. V'atemer es mishpatai l'risha min ha'goyim, and you and it rebelled against my laws for evil from the nations. Veschukosai, and my laws, mina aratos ashesivosel, from the lands that are around it. Kibim mishpatai ma'asu, for my laws they have rejected. Vechukosai lo hakuvahem, and my statutes they have not gone to them. Lachain kamar Hashem Elokim, therefore says, so says Hashem God, yan hamonchem mina goyim ashesivoseichem, since, we're in Pasuk Zayin, verse 7, since you have sinned from all the nations that are around you. The chukosai lo halachim, my statutes you have not gone. Ves mishpatai lo asisem, my laws you did not do. Uchem mishpatei hagoyim asher sidoseichem lo asisem, and you didn't do like the laws of the nations around you. We'll explain that in a moment. Lachin ko amar Hashem lakim, therefore so says Hashem God, hineni alayich gam ani, behold I am on you, also me. So asisi v'selchech mishpatim la'inei ha'goyim, and I will do amongst you laws or judgments to the eyes of the nations. V'asisi lach, and I will do in you eis asher lo asisi, that which I have not done. V'eis asher lo eesech amohu od, and that I will not do like it again. Ya'an kol tovavosayach, because of all of your abominations. And we go on as it gets worse. Lachin avos yochlu vanim b'socheif, therefore fathers will eat children amongst you. Uvanim yochlu avosam, and children will eat their fathers. V'asisi vach shvatim, and I'll do amongst you judgments. V'seilisi es kol she'ilisech l'choruach, and I will scatter all of your survivors to all the winds, to all the directions. Lachin chayaninu Hashem Elokim, therefore as I live, says Hashem God, in lo yan es mikdashi tim es, if not because you defiled my mikdash, my temple, b'chol shikutzayach v'chol tavosayach, and all your disgusting things and all your abominations, v'gamani egrav lo sachos eini, and I will also diminish you, and my eyes will not have pity, v'gamani lo echmol, also I will not have mercy. And now he explains what the symbolism was before. Shlishi seich badeva yomusu, a third of you will die in a plague. That's the third that are being burned in the city. The third of the hair that's burned in the city means that they will be killed in a plague. Uvara'av, and in famine, yichlu v'selcheich, they will be destroyed amongst you. That's one third. Ba'ashlishis, and the second third, ba'cherav yiplusi v'selcheich, they will fall at the sword around you. That's the third that he chopped with the sword and then threw out the side of the city. Ba'ashlishis, and the last third, l'chol ruach ezareh, I will scatter them all around. And I will send a sword after them, which means they will be killed as they flee, as they run away and they're out amongst the other nations, they'll be killed there. And my anger will be ended, will finish. And my anger will settle in them, and I will be consoled. V'yoduki ani Hashem, they will know that I am God. Dibarti b'kinasi, I've spoken in my kina, which here means in my zealousness. B'chalosi chamasi vam, when I finish my anger amongst them. V'ednech l'cherba u'lecherpa, and I will put you for the sword and for shame. B'agoyim asher tzivosayich, amongst the nations that are around you. Le'inei kolover, to the eyes of all that pass by. And it keeps going through the end of the parak. We're not going to get to the end today, so I'm going to leave this. We'll have to reread this parts of this as we come back to this when we continue. Now, it's a pretty depressing parak, and it's pretty serious, and we don't like to read these things. We know that our people have gone through such terrible things over the years, over the centuries, and unfortunately, these things are something we have to deal with. But so let's just understand what is happening, and then we'll explain parts of it, and we may have to leave some of it for next week or for next time. The Yechezkel is being told, as he was told in the past, to do something symbolic to show what is going to happen in the future. So he's supposed to take his hair, shave it off, and that hair is supposed to be symbolic of the Jewish people. Question number one, why the hair? Why is his hair supposed to be symbolic of the Jewish people? Why his hair? Why not something else? Why not take paper clips and use them? Why hair? That's question one. He's supposed to take that hair, divide it into thirds. A third he's supposed to burn in the city, which is symbolic of those who will die in the city from plague and famine. A third he's supposed to chop up with the sword and throw it around the city, which is symbolic of those who will be killed by the sword. A third he's supposed to throw to the wind, to all over the place. And Hashem says, and I will send a sword after them, which means they also will not survive. They'll get away from the city, they'll get away from the siege, but they will be killed when they get to the surrounding areas, to the nations around Yerushalayim. And then he's supposed to take a small amount and wrap them in his cloak. That is symbolic of those who will survive, because we know that we did survive, and we endure to this day. So there will be a small percentage that does survive. From those that survive, take another amount and throw them into the fire and burn them. Why? What is that symbolic of? Well, everything else seems to make sense. A third, a third, a third, a small amount in his cloak, those are the survivors, and then take a small amount of the survivors and throw them back into the fire. What is that symbolic of? And then Hashem explains that I have, so says Hashem God, I have this Yerushalayim, I put it in the middle of the nations, with all the nations, all the lands around it, and they have rebelled, Yerushalayim has rebelled, from all the lands that are around it. What does that mean, they've rebelled from all the lands that are around it? What does that mean? And they've not gone in my laws. And Hashem says, they have not followed my laws. And the end of Pasuk Zion, the end of verse 7, you didn't do like the statutes of the nations around you. Does that make sense? You didn't keep my laws. You didn't go with my statutes. And the laws of the nations around you didn't keep. What does that mean? It means they drove over the speed limit? What does it mean that they didn't keep the laws of the nations around them? What is Hashem alluding to over here? So these are the questions we're going to try to answer tonight. And the rest of the parak, we'll see if we have a chance to complete it tonight or not. Why the hair? Why is the hair that which is symbolic of the Jewish people over here? When Yechezkel is told to shave the hair of his head and beard, what does that remind you of?
Nazir.
Okay. So it reminds, it should remind you of a Nazir. A Nazir who, when a person takes an oath to be a Nazir, he has to refrain from shaving or getting a haircut or shaving for the term of the Nazir, of the Nazirus, which is a minimum of 30 days. It could be longer. When his time is complete, then what does he do?
Shaves.
He shaves the hair on his head and beard. He shaves everything off. What does he do with that hair? It's actually an explicit verse in the Torah. He burns it, correct. He burns it. In the karban, the sacrifice which he's cooking after it's slaughtered, and he's cooking the sacrifice, he's supposed to take his hair and throw it in the fire which is under the pot and burn it in fire. Burn the hair in fire. What is the Nazir doing when he shaves his head? By the way, there's another person that has to shave the hair on his head. Who else besides the Nazir? The Kohen, when? Good, good. The Levim, right, good. That was a one-time thing. But why do they have to do it? It's because of this other person that has to shave his head. You're right. But who else has to shave their head besides a Nazir? Someone who is a Mitzora, someone who has Tzaras. Someone who gets Tzaras, part of the purification process is to shave their head, which is why the Levim had to. Rashi explains in Parshas Baalotcha that the Levim, when they were initiated as being Levim, they also had to shave their head because they were atoning for the Jewish people who had committed Avodah Zarah. The Jewish people, therefore, were considered to be like they were Chayav Misa. They were considered to deserve capital punishment. The Levim were atoning for them, and a Mitzora, someone at Tzaras, is considered as if he's dead. And so the Levim therefore had to enact the and had to play it out as if they were had Tzaras and shaved their head. That was one of the things that Korach got upset about, that they had to shave their head. Korach thought that Moshe was making fun of them to make them shave their head, to shave their hair. So a Nazir has to shave his hair. What is the reason? What is going on with the Nazir? First he has his hair grow, and then he shaves it off. It's a funny thing, like either let the hair grow or shave it off. What is this thing? First he lets the hair grow. He could be a Nazir for 7 years. A person, the Mishnah is talking about a case of a person who accepted Nazirus for 7 years. So for 7 years, he can't cut his hair. And then, after 7 years are up, he shaves it all off. What is that meant to teach us? What is it meant to teach him? What is the idea of not shaving, even for an extended period of time, not being allowed to take a haircut or shave, and then having an obligation to shave off everything? What is that meant to be symbolic of?
Maybe he's going against who the Torah wants him to do, because the person's not supposed to take it upon himself to be Nazir.
Okay.
He's still going against normal people with shaving hair.
Correct. But over here, it seems like the part of being a Nazir is first to let it grow and then shave it. The Gemara tells the following story. The Gemara says that one of the Tanoim reports that he would never eat from the carbon. Another has to bring several carbonos, several sacrifices, when they finish. And this Tana, who was a Kohen, would never eat from the carbonos of a Nazir. Some say it's a Nazir Tameh, he would never eat from, be that as it may, he wouldn't, from a Nazir who became Tameh in the middle of his Nazirus, whatever the details are, but he would not eat from the sacrifice of a Nazir. Why wouldn't he eat from the sacrifice of a Nazir? Because he felt that most Nazirim were insincere. What do you mean they were insincere? He felt that when a person accepted upon himself to become a Nazir, at the moment when they accepted it, they meant it. And they really had good intentions. But as time wore on, and the prohibitions of Nazir became more and more difficult and tedious, the Nazir, he felt, inevitably regretted what he was doing. And therefore he felt that the carbon that was being brought was insincere. He says, except for one case, there is one time that I did eat from the carbon of a Nazir who became Tameh. And what was that case? This is one time, a young man came to me, and he had beautiful locks of hair. He had been a Nazir. So his hair, it was growing in beautiful locks of hair. He looked like a beautiful person. So I said to him, I said, Bini, my son, listen to his words, what did you see to take this beautiful hair and shave it off? That's what he said to him. Now, he hadn't yet shaved it off. It was still there. But what he was saying is that the purpose of becoming a Nazir is not to let the hair grow, it's to eventually shave it off. That's the point that the person is aiming for. So what did you see that you accepted upon yourself to be a Nazir and this beautiful hair of yours that you're going to go and shave it off? So he says, I'll tell you. He says, I was shepherding for my father out in the wilderness, and I came to a stream of water. Now, I remember in those days, a mirror was very rare. It was very rare to see your own reflection. Women had some sort of copper, which they could look in for a mirror, but men certainly almost never saw themselves. In fact, although today it's commonplace for men to look in mirrors, but in the time of the Gemara, it was prohibited. It was usur for a man to look in the mirror. It was considered to be beged isha. It was considered to be like wearing women's clothing, would be to look in the mirror. Just as we know, that issur in the Torah about a man wearing women's clothing and a woman wearing man's clothing is not just wearing clothing, but it's engaging in practices that are specific to each gender. So it's usur for a woman to engage in a practice which is specific for men. It's usur for a man to engage in a practice which is specific for women. In those days, one of those things was looking in a mirror. Because it was not common for a man to look in a mirror. And so he says, I was there in the wilderness, and I looked in, I had to get water from a pond, and I looked in the water, and I saw my reflection. And I said to myself, wow, I'm really beautiful. And then I caught myself, and I said to my Yetzer Hara, to my evil inclination, I said, how can you be haughty in this world which is not your own? I swear I will shave you off for God. In other words, what he said is, I caught myself becoming a Baal Gaiva, becoming haughty, seeing how beautiful I looked. And I said to myself, I've got to arrest this, I've got to nip it in the bud before it really gets to me. And so I said that I will become a Nazir, and then I will be forced to let my hair grow till it's really beautiful, and I'm going to take that beauty and shave it. You imagine a person who's coming to shul every week, and they're beautiful, the hair is beautiful and everything, and they look great. And then you come to shul the next week and you see the person, and they have no hair at all on their head. What happened, right? It's a way of controlling his gaiva, his haughtiness, that he shouldn't feel that he's so special. That's what he said he's going to do. So he's going to take that hair and be makdishit l'shamayim and make it holy, shave it off, and give it up. And so when he brought his karban, when he brought his sacrifice, the Tana said, the sage said, that I will eat from, because he's clearly sincere. Someone who becomes a Nazir for that reason is obviously sincere, and therefore he was willing to eat from his karban. hair is perhaps representative of the beauty of a person. We know that married women are obligated to cover their hair. This is part of, it's not the only facet of a person's beauty, but it seems to be that which stands out as a person's beauty. That's what it seems to be. It seems to be, I know this is somewhat of a pun, but it seems to be the crowning glory. That's what it seems to be. And the Nazir, part of what he's doing, so he's not involved in drinking wine, and he's not involved in with dead people, with becoming Tamei. It seems that he's also taking that which is the most beautiful and removing it and giving it over to God, letting it become really beautiful and then taking it off for God. That's what it seems to be that he's doing, to arrest that gaiva. But that's what seems to be what hair is symbolic of. I wonder with Yechezkel if that's the message that the Jews are getting, that the Jews themselves are the beauty of mankind. We Jews are the beauty of the world. We Jews represent Hashem in this world. We Jews are the crowning glory of all creation. And that is therefore represented by the hair. We have the capacity to be the most beautiful of all that Hashem created. I'm talking in a spiritual sense. And the Jews obviously have not lived up to those expectations. And so Yechezkel is told, take your hair, shave it off, and take that hair. That hair is going to represent the Jewish people. And now all of the calamity I'm going to bring to them is going to be through your hair. The hair is going to be what is symbolic of it. On the flip side, it may also be that Hashem is saying that just as with the Nazir, once the hair is removed, the message is sent home, meaning that now that special Nazir, it seems to be that story I told you, the Gemara relates, it seems to be that's the quintessential Nazir. It seems to be that's the perfect Nazir. If you want to do Nazir right, that's the way to do it. So it seems that the atonement, the kapara that will come along with the punishment, is going to have the same effect as a Nazir done correctly. That the hair will be removed, and now there'll be room for healing. Now it'll be able for the Jews to get back to where they're supposed to be. A third, yes, question.
The hair is removed, but the hair will grow back.
Correct.
So,
I believe you're right. I believe you're right. The hair is removed, but it grows back for most people. So it grows back. So the idea being that it's not a right, like you were saying, it's not a complete destruction. It's a renewal, right? So this has to go, but now you're going to start again, and it's going to be okay. You'll learn how to do it right.
But when a Nazir gets their hair removed. Is
that's correct. That's correct. That's correct. And then he's just a regular person. He lets it grow back, and then he keeps it however he wants to keep it.
That's just for the initial shock.
Right.
The initial
change. That's right. That's right. It seems to be for this one person, it was going to be that from here on in, that he would recall that humiliation of walking into shul that next week, and it's all gone. And he'll recall that, and then he won't let his gaiva, he won't become a bon gaiva, he won't let his haughtiness get to him.
There was a connection with the Nazir with the hair and the mourner. The mourner is also forbidden to cut his hair.
That's correct, but he's not obligated to shave it off afterwards. That seems to be to look disheveled. That seems to be with the mourning. That's this period of time during the 3 weeks. That seems to be in order to look disheveled. But a Nazir, I don't think looked disheveled, because I mean the story in the Gemara is that he had beautiful hair, and you know Avshalom is a classic case. Avshalom, the son of David HaMelech, who had the long hair, it was beautiful. That ended up being his demise. But that was, it seemed to be a symbol of beauty. A third gets burned in the city, a third gets cut by the sword, a third gets scattered, and a sword follows them. Take from there, in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, take from there a small amount and wrap it in your cloak. That's going to be the survivors. But then, Pasuk Dalet, from them, meaning from the survivors, take a little bit and throw it back in the fire. What is that symbolic of? Rashi tells us to think of the story which is brought in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And the story, you may have heard the story before. The story goes as follows. After the Jews were already in Golos, they were in exile, there was a great tzaddik whose name was Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol. Not to be confused with the Yehoshua, who is the prime disciple of Moshe Rabbeinu, who succeeds Moshe as the leader of the Jewish people and takes us into Eretz Israel. There's another Yehoshua. Yehoshua, the disciple of Moshe Rabbeinu, came from which Shevet? Which tribe? No. Which? Not Binyamin? Ephraim. Ephraim. From Yosef, from Ephraim. So he was not, obviously couldn't be a Kohen, because he's from Ephraim. A Kohen is only from Levi. So Yehoshua Kohen Gadol, later on, different person, he was the Kohen Gadol who would later be there for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash and end up serving in the Beis HaMikdash. Nebuchadnezzar, who was the one who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, had a daughter. And there were two Jews. One of them's name was Achav ben Koliah, not to be confused with the Achav, King Achav, different Achav, although he was also evil. This Achav ben Koliah, he had a friend, I believe his name was Elazar. Let me see if Rashi says the name. Achav ben Koliah and Tzidkiah ben Maasiah. Those are the two people. They were not your most righteous Jews. They were in Bavel, in Gullus. They were in Babylonia. And they had designs on Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. So each one independently went to his daughter, the princess, and said to her that, you know, I am a prophet. I'm a Navi. And God told me that you are to have a relationship with me. And each said that. So this daughter was skeptical and she went to Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar called the two before him. They also thought it was going to work because what ended up happening was pretty... So he called them before him and he says to them, I thought your God isn't into this kind of behavior. So they said, no, we're prophets, and God told us this. So he said, well, you know, I'm pretty sure he said Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Yeah, I checked with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Remember, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are the three friends of Daniel who refused to bow down. And Nebuchadnezzar said everybody has to bow down to the idol. These three remained standing, they didn't bow down, and they got thrown into a furnace, and they came out alive. So he says, I checked with them, and they said that this behavior is unacceptable. So the two of them, Achav and Tzidkiah, said to Nebuchadnezzar, well, they're prophets, and we're also prophets. So God told us a different thing. So Nebuchadnezzar said, well, you know, those three, they're tried and true. You know, I once threw them into a fire. They came out alive. So in my book, you know, they have credentials. I've never tested you two. So how about if we throw you into a fire too? And if you come out alive, then I'll know that you're prophets and that you we should go with what you're saying as well. So the two of them, who were no fools, they said, well, you know, you can't just throw us into the fire because that won't really be a test. The reason why Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah survived the fire is because it was three righteous people. So three righteous people, three together, that was enough to stave off the effects of the fire. We're only two, so we won't be able to survive in the fire. That's not a fair test. So Nebuchadnezzar said, okay, I can hear that. Pick a third, and I'll throw all three of you in, and we'll see what happens. So the two of them picked Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. They figured, we know Yehoshua is very righteous. God won't let Yehoshua burn. And if we stay really close to him, then if he survives, we'll survive. We'll just hang out real close to him in the fire, in the cool part of the fire. So That's what happened. And Nebuchadnezzar threw all three of them into the fire. And of course, the two of them were burned to a crisp. And Yehoshua Kahingadol came out alive. The rest of the story is Yehoshua Kahingadol's clothes were singed. Even though he came out alive, but his clothes were singed. So Nebuchadnezzar said to him, "How come with Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah? They came out and their clothes were fine, but you, your clothes were singed." So Yehoshua answered, "Because there was three righteous people. You threw me in with two evil people." The protection wasn't all there. So Nebuchadnezzar accepted that, and everything was fine. The truth is that the Gemara says that was just a way of getting Nebuchadnezzar to stop his questioning, but there was another reason why his clothes were singed, and it had to do with his children. That's a whole story. Perhaps if we learn Daniel, we learn Ezra and Nehemiah, maybe at that point we can discuss that story further. At any rate, Rashi tells us that this group that he took and put into his cloak, which is the survivors, from the survivors, take out a few and throw them back into the fire. That's, for example, Achav and Tzidkiah, these two evil people. For example, I mean, it doesn't mean there's only two. What is being brought out from that? And this is startling. Yeah? Okay. The people that survive this incredible destruction, you would think are going to be the greatest of the Jewish people. Moreover, you would think that they are going to act as righteous as possible. They're going to have seen all this destruction and see they're the only ones who survived. They're going to rededicate themselves to Hashem. But says the Navi, Hashem tells Yechezkel, that's not necessarily so. That even amongst the survivors in Bavel, there's still going to be trouble. It doesn't mean everybody's going to say, okay, we've got to get together, we've got to really work hard to work back to Hashem in order to go back to Yerushalayim in 70 years. You would think that should be people's reaction, but that's not necessarily so. And even from the survivors, still there are going to be some that are going to be thrown back in the fire, who will not be zocha, will not merit to go on to go back to Yerushalayim. And so that's the symbolism of what's going on over here. And then finally, from that little remnant that remains, and after those that were taken out of the remnant have been removed, that group will actually survive and go back to Yerushalayim after the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. And that's the symbolism over here. It's a pretty depressing thought, just how Hashem is weeding out and weeding out and weeding out and getting down to such a small amount of people that will end up surviving this horrible, horrible destruction. Now you understand, just to reiterate what we've said in the previous weeks, that Yechezkel going through these motions is not simply foreshadowing, but it's also a form of atonement, a form of kapara. And it is diminishing the destruction somewhat because he is going through this. The humiliation that Yechezkel is going to go through by shaving off all of his hair will be an atonement somewhat for the Jewish people so that their punishment is somewhat diminished. Then Hashem says, and just so we can make sure to answer the third question before our time is up, then Hashem says that this is Yerushalayim amongst the nations, and you have rebelled from all the nations. You have rebelled. So says Hashem, because you've sinned, you have not gone in my ways, you have not kept my statutes, the end of Pasuk Zion, uchemishpeteha goyim asher sivoseichem lo asisem, and you did not do like the statutes of the nations that are around you. This does not mean Dina de Bachusa Dina, this does not mean that they weren't keeping the law of the land. That is not what is being referred to over here. The Jews weren't in the law of weren't in a foreign nation. They were in their own nation. They were in Israel. There was no foreign law to keep. Those rules about keeping foreign law is when you live in a foreign nation. They were living in Israel under a Jewish king. So there was no foreign law to keep. So what is it meant over here that you didn't even keep what the nations say? So, Chazal tell us, our sages say, and Rashi actually alludes to it over here, that when the Jews sinned, and they committed idolatry. They did that which even the nations of the world wouldn't do. They took it to a new level, to new heights, with new depths, if you want to put it that way. The pasuk tells us in Ha'azinu, Chadashim mikarov bo, new things that are here for the first time. Lo se'arum avos seichem. Your ancestors' hair didn't rise up when they heard it. They never dealt with these things before. The Jewish people, when they have sunk so low that they're willing to do things that even the nations of the world wouldn't do. And that's what Hashem is saying. You're more evil on a certain level than all the nations around you. It's bad enough that you were influenced by them, you didn't keep my laws, but you went further. The Gemara tells us that there is an Avodah Zarah. We actually learned about it in last week's Parsha, at the end of Parsha's Chukas, the end of Parsha's Balak, called Baal Par. And Baal Par is an Avodah Zarah, it's an idol, and it's an idolatry, and the way that this idol is served is that the one who is serving the idol defecates in front of the idol. So all kinds of forms of idolatry, and this is one of them. The way to serve it is to defecate in front of it. The Gemara tells us there was once a Jew that came to the priests of this idol and said, I would like to worship Par. They said, okay, go right ahead. And so he did. And then he said, I'd like to do something more. I said, what would you like to do? And he proceeded to clean himself on the nose of the idol. And when the priests saw this, they said, wow, we've never thought of such great service. What an unbelievably insightful way of serving the idol. They were very, very impressed. Something they had never seen before. And who came up with the new way of serving Par? It was a Jew that came up with it. When he sunk so low that he outdid the non-Jews. He outdid those who actually created the idolatry in the first place. Why? What is that? How would I understand that? I would think that we are expected to be a cut above the nations of the world because we are a cut above the nations of the world. Why would it be that when sinning, it seems that we have the capacity to sink further than they do?
We see it with our teenagers nowadays. You know, when they're allowed to do something to kids, then the teenagers sort of do it, but not too crazy. But when not allowed, and the teenagers are doing it anyway, so they wind up rebelling worse than the kids that were allowed to be doing it. You do more bad things and get deeper and deeper. When you rebel, then you rebel, you go deeper. And when it's okay, so you just do it.
Okay. So you're saying that when a person is doing something that they know is wrong and they were told not to do, they really throw off everything. There's a sense of, like you said, rebellion. I would say that it is a there's a tendency to want to completely rebel. Once I'm doing it, I'm going to do it right. Okay? Anything else?
The world is kind of balanced. It's much better to you to do that same amount of evil. So the more that you're capable of, the more easier.
Okay, so if you have a capacity for great good, then you have a capacity for great evil. A person who has capacity for great good is a capacity for great evil. The way our sages express that idea over here is they say that one way that the Jews did worse than the non-Jews is that the non-Jews weren't giving up the real thing. They didn't give up the real thing. They didn't have the real thing in the first place. So they worship an idol that is pointless, that is ridiculous. But they're not exchanging an idol for God, because they don't have God. We, if we worship an idol, are exchanging a something which is inanimate and has no power for the real thing, for the actual power, for Hashem. That's far worse. And so the Jewish people therefore sink lower at least in some respect. Now, it should be noted that although it is true that we may have the capacity to think lower, the spark that makes us Jewish is still there, and as a result, we still have that ability to rise back up to the great heights that we can, we're supposed to be at. But when one throws it off, one sinks very low. When Rus and Arpa were attempted to go with Naomi back to Eretz Yisrael, and Naomi tried to dissuade them, and Rus, as we know, was persistent, and she stayed with her mother-in-law with Naomi and went back with her. But Arpa gave it up. In the end, she gave it up. She listened to her mother-in-law. She couldn't go on, and she turned around and went back. The Gemara tells us that that night that she went back, that she had been close to going to Eretz Yisrael, she had been close to going on with Naomi, and instead she turned around and went back. That night, she had a relationship with 100 men and a dog. That's what the Gemara says. So whether the Gemara is exaggerating, it could be the Gemara is exaggerating. Sometimes the Gemara does. But the point the Gemara is making is that she really, really sunk low. Once she gave it up, she just dropped like a ton of bricks. And that seems to be an element of what is going on over here. When a person is so close to greatness and then throws it off or feels rejected or whatever it is, they fall. It's a precipitous drop. Igra rama labira mikta, from a great height to an incredible depth. And that seems to be what is being brought out over here, that when the Jewish people fell, they fell in a horrible way. We're not in a good place to stop, meaning that this is not a pleasant place to stop. The rest of the parak is not pleasant, and we're going to have to pick up from here next time we learn. Let me shut this first.